All right, let me draw a brief diagram first to begin today, because we have two streams of philosophy in the ancient world, and these two streams of philosophy begin with Plato and Aristotle, and they continue down through history. Plato was taken up by Augustine, and so he had a Platonic form of expression of Christianity, and Aristotle was taken up by Aquinas. The difference between these two streams is that Plato stresses the a priori, which means independent of experience, prior to experience. And Aristotle stressed the a posteriori, which means from experience. Plato stressed that we are born with innate ideas, and stressed the mind. Aristotle said we are born a blank slate, tabula rasa, and all of these ideas come from our experience, not from our mind. They come from the senses. Now, these two traditions continued down through history, and they were picked up in the modern world. In the modern world, this line represents the modern world, that's the ancient. In the modern world, they were picked up by people who were called empiricists and rationalists. The rationalists followed Plato's tradition, and the empiricists followed Aristotle's tradition. Now, the word rationalist is self-explanatory, and the word empiricist simply means coming from the empirical senses, from the five senses, what you see, touch, smell, hear, etc. The rationalists were basically three. There was Descartes, who was the French rationalist. He was the one who said, I think, therefore I am. Then there was Spinoza, who was the Jewish Dutch rationalist. And then finally Leibniz, who was a German. So Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz, starting in the early 1600s now, we're talking about, just after the Reformation, 1600s and following. The empiricists were John Locke, who also, in many respects, was the father of the, the grandfather of the American Constitution, because of both his political views and his natural law views, because Thomas Jefferson followed John Locke, and Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. There was Bishop Berkeley, who started a college in Rhode Island that later went defunct. Bishop Berkeley, and then David Hume, one of the most important philosophers of all time, and certainly of modern time. These two strains of philosophy carried on the ancient traditions of Plato and Aristotle in a slightly revised form, but they did stress them respectively, the mind innate and a priori, rationalist, and the empiricist Locke, Berkeley, and Hume stressed a posteriori, getting information from the senses. The great genius of Immanuel Kant is that these two traditions were brought into together by the greatest philosopher of modern times, Immanuel Kant. And Immanuel Kant reconciled these two traditions, saying in the sense they're both right, but when he did, he gave rise to agnosticism, because what he said simply was, sure, we are born with a priori categories and forms, so the form of all knowledge we get by birth. We're born with these little jello molds, but the jello molds are empty, and the content of all of our knowledge comes from experience. So the empiricists were right about where we get the content. The rationalists were right about where we get the form. Our mind forms out the content, the amorphous content, like amorphous jello coming into the mold, and our mind is the mold, and it forms out the jello into little star shapes and heart shapes and whatever shapes you want. And the result of that is what we call knowledge. The only problem is we don't know what the jello was like before we formed it, because you can only know after your mind works on it. You can't know the thing in itself. So by that, Immanuel Kant generated agnosticism by synthesizing rationalism and empiricism. So it was a stroke of genius on his part, but the stroke of genius gave rise to virtually everything else in the modern world in which we are now trying to put together our thoughts as a result of Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant, then, is the crossroads of modern philosophy. He died in 1804. He's right in the middle of the chart, indicating his importance. Rationalism, the a priori, is coming into him, and we give the people plus their dates there. Descartes, 1650, Spinoza, 1677, and Leibniz died in 1716. And the reason we put the date of their death is that most people are more influential and wrote more of their mature works closer to death than they did their birth. And then on the bottom, you have Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, 1704, 1754, and died in a very famous year for Americans, 1776, same year our crew was born. Notice also on the bottom, Bacon, Francis Bacon, and Thomas Hobbes fit in this tradition just before Locke, 1620 and 1650, Novum Organum and Leviathan, two very famous books are in the Great Book series as well. Immanuel Kant synthesized these. He said the mind and the form come a priori, as rationalists said, the senses and the content are a posteriori. We can't know the thing before we formed it. We only know it after we formed it. So we don't know the thing in itself. We just know the thing to me. We don't know the ding on zick. We just know the ding for mick. And we don't know the world, we just know the phenomenal world. We know the world of phenomena, and we're forever locked out. There is indeed, as a result of that, a great gulf fixed. I am on this side. God in reality is on this side. All I know is right up to there. I know things to me, but I cannot know things as they really are in themselves. Therefore, I must be forever agnostic regarding knowing reality. I can believe it, I can intuit, I can mystically intuit it, I can practically use it. He never gave up his belief in God. He became an atheist. He never became an agnostic about the existence of God. He just is an agnostic about knowing whether there is a God by the mind. So you must just believe, will, live, stick with moral, stick over here in the realm of fact, but the realm of value, the realm of God is over here exactly the same as Plotinus's one. The one is in the mystical, not knowable. It is a kind of Plotinian gulf as well as a Kantian gulf, hence the tremendous importance of Plotinus. Now, for the rest of the course, we're going to be working out the implications of these great thinkers before Kant, synthesis he did to all of theology and all of thought after him. If you don't understand this chart and you don't understand the flow of modern thought, Kant, then the rest of modern thought won't make any sense at all, because it all starts right there with Immanuel Kant, and hence I gave you a reading from one of his most important works so that you can get a feel for his philosophy. If I had given you a reading from the Critique of Pure Reason, about 700 pages, you wouldn't understand a word of it if you don't have a background in philosophy. This is probably one of the heaviest, hardest books in the history of thought, but it is still one of the most important books. Even he was disappointed that people didn't understand it, and so he wrote a second one called The Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, and that one is virtually unintelligible unless you're an expert in philosophy as well. Because if you only know things after you have molded them, not what they were before you molded them, then you don't know what they are in themselves. You just know what they are after you molded them. If you're born with empty jello molds and experience amorphous, shapeless experience out here is coming in and is going to fill that mold, and you only know it after it is shaped by your mind, your a priori structures, then you have no way in the world. Not only do you not know, you can't know. It's impossible for you to know it, because it is beyond the very nature of the knowing process. The knowing process demands that your mind and your a priori categories and forms stamp it out, and so you can't know it before you know it. You know the phenomenal world. You know the world to me. You know the scientific world. You know the world of your experience. You know the world of the phenomena. You know all of this on this side of the gulf. That's the world to you. And the world to you is to you your world. Just stick with it. Don't try and leap over here into the metaphysical. Now, that's not to say this isn't important. In fact, that's where value is. That's where God is. That's where ultimate reality is. And then you want to believe that. But leave it in the realm of belief. Don't try and scientifically understand it. Don't try and scrutinize it. Don't try and prove it. Just believe it. This? No. This is an objective world of your senses. This is a real objective scientific world. Newton's law, which Kant believed was a universal law of gravitation, gave him confidence to believe that we could know this world and know it with some kind of certainty, and we could devise scientific laws. Kant himself devised the nebular hypothesis. He was the originator of the nebular hypothesis and a naturalistic approach to origins. So we can know this world to us, but don't suppose that your scientific knowledge tells you anything about ultimate reality. It requires what?
Passivity, but God is passive. The whole effort in knowing comes from man. And he does. That's what I understand about Plato. The one is not doing anything down, it's going from down to up. And how are you sure that that's the way?
Another way to ask that question is there revelation in Kant's system? Does the other side ever break through? That's an interesting question, and of course the title of Kant's book, Revelation, Reason Within the Limits, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone, is the title of his book. So if reason is within the limits of, or religion is within the limits of reason alone, there is no propositional revelation from the other side. That is not to say there is no revelation from the other side, or there cannot be revelation, but if there is, it's going to be subjective, experiential, it's going to be existential, neo-orthodox type revelation, where God grabs you, or where you leap over to him. Whoever takes the initiative is incidental to the essential Kantian system, but there is no propositional revelation from the other side. There can't be. Why? Because it's impossible. It's not only impossible for you to go over here and know this, it's impossible for this to come over here and state anything about itself or a myth to live by. It would be a way to think about him, but not the way he really is. And that's exactly where we are in modern theology. That's exactly where Bultmann and the Neo-Orthodox took us. This is reality, this is the phenomena, this is what things are to us. This is reality to us, this is reality in itself. So this is not that this is unreality, but it is kind of akin to Plato's cave, his world of shadows, because the world of shadows aren't totally unreal, because there are images behind them, and the shadow is telling you about some real image there that's being cast on the wall. So it's very similar. It's kind of the updating. That's why Whitehead said modern philosophy is a series of footnotes on Plato, stating it in a little different way. Well, we'll get into that in a moment. That's a very good critique, and we'll develop that critique when we get to Kant. But I just wanted you to get the flow of where we're going before we go there, so that you're not totally lost here when we start talking about Spinoza as to how he fits in. No, because Jesus probably implied intrinsic causal connection, and Kant is talking about an extrinsic causal connection. And the difference, as we pointed out yesterday, is that the effect of hot water is to produce a hard egg. That's an extrinsic connection. But hot water produces a hot egg. That's an intrinsic connection. So Kant is following through the Platonic idea that the cause only produces an extrinsically related effect that's not similar to itself.
Would he give God credit for all this?
Yes. Yes, Kant believes in God. He believes that God is out there. He believes that God is important. He believes that you ought to believe in God, but he is a deist. He does not believe in miracles, as we'll see. He does not believe in supernatural propositional revelation, and therefore he's the father of modern liberalism. He believes that you ought to live a moral life and that Christianity ought to be understood morally, but not revelatorily. Yes. He meant you ought to live so as to universalize everything you believe is true. If you believe it's wrong to lie, then will that as a universal, categorical imperative for everyone. And if you believe that killing is wrong, then don't make any exceptions. Killing is wrong for everybody. And you can tell whether something is a moral principle by whether indeed it is universalizable without being self-destructive. For example, if I will lying to be a universal law, then everybody can lie. And if everybody lied about everything, there'd be no more truth to lie about. And if there's no more truth to lie about, you can't even lie. So lying is self-destructive. If I willed killing to be a universal law, there'd be no more people to kill. Therefore, it's self-destructive. Therefore, those are wrong. We'll see when we get to him. I'll pass for now. He has some very good reasons. In fact, one of the most profound arguments for anti-supernaturalism, along with David Hume. Yes, we do have other options than Kant, and we'll show what they are. So let's begin with Spinoza, so that we can see how they fit in. Spinoza, Life and Works, 1632 to 1677. He was born in 1632 to Portuguese Jewish refugees in Amsterdam. He was a lens grinder by trade. He never taught philosophy. He was excommunicated from the synagogue in 1656 for believing God is extended, angels are imaginary, and denying the biblical teaching on the immortality of the soul. I.e., he was excommunicated because he was a pantheist, and Jews are monotheists. Albert Einstein was a pantheist. When Albert Einstein was asked by a rabbi, what God do you believe in? Einstein said, God doesn't play dice with the universe. And so people were interested in what kind of God he believed in. Einstein said, I believe in the God of Spinoza. So Einstein, his quest for a universal field theory is really a quest for a naturalistic explanation of the whole universe. So if you think Spinoza is dead, you'd have to say Einsteinian relativity is dead, or the whole quest for unified theory is dead. Spinoza's main works were Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, Tractatus Politicus. I don't know why he couldn't abbreviate that title. Looks like it stutters. And Ethics, 1670 and 1674. I would say one of the greatest literary sleepers in the history of modern philosophy is his Tractatus. He wrote that book pseudonymously, without putting his name to it, and it passed around Europe between 1670 and 1700. It was one of the hottest books in Europe. It went through a dozen printings, which was a lot in those days. All of the intellectuals were heavily influenced by it, and you can talk to virtually anybody, and most people don't even know he wrote a book like that. And it was Richard Simone that read this book, and it became the father of modern biblical criticism. So it's an extremely important book. He died of TB in A.D. He didn't die of TB A.D., but he died of TB in A.D. 1677. He was influenced by several important thinkers. Guess who? Plotinus. The Jewish philosopher Moses Maimonides, who believed in rationalism and allegorism. He was a late Middle Age philosopher that Thomas Aquinas referred to many times. Euclid's geometry, geometrical rationalism, the belief that you could take basic axioms and deduce all mathematical truths, appealed to Spinoza, and he said, why can't we do this in philosophy? Find self-evident axioms and deduce all philosophical truth from them. And Sir Isaac Newton, who was a contemporary of his and who had already discovered a universal believed to be a universal natural law, the law of gravity. And they believe that this was a model for understanding all of nature. When we can understand universal laws that have no exceptions, there are no exceptions to gravity, as he understood it, Newton and Spinoza, then we will eliminate all miracles. And although Sir Isaac Newton was a Christian and a theist, Spinoza was a pantheist, and Sir Isaac Newton's laws appealed to him as a way of explaining away miracles, which he proceeded to do. Two, his method, which he called the method of healing the understanding from error. The whole purpose of philosophy is to heal your mind of the sickness of error. Influences on Spinoza: Judaism, strong stress on the unity of God; Moses, Maimonides, God is necessary being and reason is independent of revelation; Descartes, contemporary, the use of Euclid's mathematical method in philosophy; Philo, the Jewish philosopher just before the time of Christ, God is the ground of all being; the Bible is not to be interpreted literally but allegorically; and Plotinus, God is all, pantheism. Those are the main influences on him. Four levels of knowing, or degrees of perception. He said that there is hearsay level, where you have only conventional signs. These are unreliable. They never attain to the real essence of things. Then there's undisciplined experience. Then there's scientific inference from effect to cause. Understanding essence is only indirectly, but the real way to know is by direct intuitive insight into the essence or nature of all things, where you understand their nature directly. His goal, union of the mind and the whole of nature, that is to heal the mind injured by error, and his procedure, meditation, not New Age meditation, but thinking, cognitive meditation, thinking on absolutely perfect idea. Just meditate on what is an absolutely perfect idea. So in this sense, he was also influenced by Saint Anselm, who 1000 AD thought on the perfect idea and came up with the ontological argument for the existence of God. Spinoza developed a whole rationalistic, geometric rationalism out of it. His approach: define axioms and make deductions. This has the advantage of, one, aiding the weak mind. It's impersonal, and it yields certainty in its conclusions, all of which appealed to rationalists. If you could be absolutely certain by using axioms, why float around in the flux of experience where you're never sure what's going on? B, the application and conclusion. God must be conceived as a being existing through himself, self-caused, which is known as causa sui, which is not a new kind of Chinese food. Causa sui means a self-caused being. Remember this, because it's going to be a problematic concept in modern philosophy. Is God a self-caused being, or is God an uncaused being? Spinoza and the rationalists are going to call God self-caused, and that's going to lead to atheism. Because once you call God a self-caused being, you have just said God is impossible, because you can't cause yourself. What they should have been teaching is aseity, and aseity means that God is uncaused. And right here is a very important error, speaking of God as self-caused. At any rate, he does, and let's finish his argument. God must be conceived as existing through himself, self-caused. Two, there can only be one absolutely independent self-caused being. Three, all other beings are modally, that is, they are just modes. They're modally dependent on God. These modes are not accidents, which imply imperfection. They are moments or aspects of God. You and I are just thoughts in the mind of God. You and I are just little dimensions to the infinite. We're drops in an infinite pond. Maybe some of us drips in an infinite pond. Who knows? Someone said a drizzle is just two drips going steady. Well, this would be one big drizzle. God's attributes in himself and his properties to us should be distinguished. What God is in himself, we call attributes. What he is to us are properties. The only two attributes of God we know are thought and extension. God is identical to the whole universe. The universe is extended, God is extended. And God is a thinking being. So there is a universal mind. Now, here's a very interesting difference between pantheism and materialism. Materialism says everything is reducible to matter. Pantheism says everything is reducible to mind. There are really only three basic views in the history of thought. One says all is mind, the other says all is matter, and the other one says there's both mind and matter. Theism fits into the middle category. Karl Marx put it beautifully. He said, either matter produced mind or mind produced matter. Materialists believe that matter produced mind. Theists believe that mind produced matter. That's the difference between atheism and theism. Or to put it in a popular way, either God created man or man created God. Atheists say man created God. Theists say God created man. Theists say God created all. Pantheists say God is all. And atheists say there is no God at all. Atheism, pantheism, and theism are the three great competitive theories today. In fact, we stand on our own Mars Hill, Acts 17. Paul, the theist, ministered to the Epicureans, the atheists, and the Stoics, the pantheists. And the enemy shifts a little. Sometimes the pantheists are in ascendancy, as today the New Agers are. Sometimes the humanists are in the ascendancy, as they were 10, 20 years ago in America, where we have the same two enemies, pantheists and atheists, and either one of them will swallow us up very easily, as the pantheists are today. Spinoza is one of the precursors of modern pantheism. Four, truth and error. Truth is known only through a true idea. How else could you know the truth? Perfect truth is known only through a perfect idea. Error has four causes. Partial nature of our minds provides only fragmentary expressions of ideas. Imagination is affected by physical senses and confuses us. Reasoning is often too abstract and general. Or the failure to begin with the perfect idea. If you begin the wrong place, you're going to end up in the wrong place. You don't want to begin in senses, as David Hume did, or in doubt, as Descartes. Where you begin is where you end. Remedy for error? Return to the perfect idea of God. The more we feed, meditate, on the perfect idea, the more perfect we become. Inner growth, which results, helps us distinguish confused sensations from clear ideas. Now he gives us an example of how to do this in his famous proof for the existence of God. First statement, there must be a cause for everything, both existence and non-existence. That's a very strange premise. I don't know any theist who ever said you have to have a cause for nothing. You always have to have a cause for something, but to have a cause for nothing is a very strange premise. Nevertheless, he proceeds, a necessary being must necessarily exist, unless there is a cause adequate to explain its non-existence. But there is no cause adequate to explain why a necessary being does not exist, for such a cause would have to be either inside of God's nature or outside of it. But no cause inside a necessary existence could possibly annul its existence. And nothing inside a necessary existence could annul it either, because nothing inside a necessary being denies it is a necessary being. So you couldn't have a cause either outside or inside annulling it.